Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. Sebastian, and I am here with Jennifer.
Hello.
We are welcoming you to our annual Halloween month coverage. I'm taking a break from the Disney debacles with Richard to talk some horror movies for the next 4 weeks, starting with this episode, which is going to be Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning. And the reason why we chose this one is because it's high time we talked a little Jason Voorhees, don't you think?
I think this podcast has gone on way too long without any Jason Voorhees. Even Freddy Krueger's been in here. Michael Myers has been in.
Yeah, Michael Myers, we did Halloween too.
I know, but I mean, he's going to be in again. And I mean, if you count Halloween 3 or not, I mean, he's not in that.
But it is the franchise.
It is part of the franchise.
Yes. We needed to start talking a little bit about Friday the 13th because I know we've mentioned the movies in passing, but we needed to pick one of them and really zero in on the franchise. Now, the reason why we picked this one is not because it is the most financially unsuccessful of the series. I believe that both Jason Takes Manhattan and Jason Lives are less financially successful than this. However, this was the first film in the franchise where things started to go off the rails. People were not happy with this movie in terms of the fans. I mean, the movies have never gotten good reviews from the critics, so that's just par for the course. This did get terrible, terrible reviews. And it did make less money than any of the previous Friday the 13ths had made, but it still made like a buttload of money. It made $22 million on like a $2 million budget, which is a huge profit. Yet it was largely considered a misstep or a failure in terms of the franchise. Now, Jennifer, you are a fan of this franchise. Why don't you let people know your feelings about the Friday the 13th series.
I am a fan of the franchise. I am a fan of the franchise up until about 6. 1 through 6, I will watch pretty much any time. I don't hate Jason X. I think that that's a good time as well. I also do enjoy the remake. I've saw that in the theater. Like, it's really part 7 that's just really a snooze fest for me. I like the idea of Jason Takes Manhattan, but it's, you know, it's just not one I really go back to. It's 1 through 6 for me.
That's fair. I feel mostly the same way. I like the first film for what it is, but it sort of stands alone as its own thing because it's really like a 10 Little Indians whodunit kind of thing without Jason Voorhees as the killer, as everybody knows.
Spoiler.
But then Jason gets introduced in part 2, which I do like quite a bit. It's more of sort of a standard slasher. He doesn't have his signature look yet at that point. He's just got the bag over his head, not the hockey mask.
He's Hillbilly Jason.
He's Hillbilly Jason, but I do enjoy that movie for being just a straightforward early 80s slasher, which is a genre that I like. Part 3 is a lot of fun because of the goofy 3D elements. It was shot in 3D, as most people know. You know, I love the character of Shelley.
That's right.
Who the actor, I'm forgetting his name right now.
Larry Zerner.
Larry Zerner, who used to attend our horror trivia.
That's right.
I like part 4 probably the best. That's probably my favorite. That one features Corey Feldman and also Crispin Glover. It's got my favorite Jason in that. We have an action figure of that specific Jason, although we do have many Jason action figures.
I think we have 5 Jason action figures. Also, Lawrence Munson is in part 4 from The Last American Virgin.
That's right, yeah. So, yeah, it's a stacked cast of heavy hitters.
That's right.
And, yeah, that one I just feel is kind of the best overall Friday the 13th movie, although it doesn't feature a summer camp, so it kind of loses a point just for that. But, you know, they didn't really feature summer camps much after part 2.
No, not at all.
This movie being no exception to not featuring summer camps.
Oh, it's a different kind of camp.
I do enjoy part 6, but that's kind of going into more campy direction. It does also return to a summer camp. I think that's a really fun movie, and I think a lot of people, that is their favorite one, but it's a little on the silly side for me to totally love it the best. I do think it's one of the best of the series, but I like part 4 better because part 4 is still trying to be a horror movie. After part 6, things get goofy. And I think that's why you don't like part 7 so much, because in that one, they try to introduce the psychic girl into it. Which is kind of like, do we really need a psychic Carrie in with our Jason? Are those really two great tastes that taste great together?
I obviously didn't think so. I mean, I don't hate it. I can't even tell you really what happens in it, other than I do remember the blonde girl is psychic and...
Oh, some shit happens.
It's just not one that I like to revisit often.
Jason Takes Manhattan is just disappointing because the concept of it is so promising, but it's really just Jason on a boat for most of the movie.
It could have been so great. We don't get much of him in Manhattan at all.
No. And I mean, when he is in quote unquote Manhattan, it's mostly like Vancouver. They did shoot one night in Times Square. So there is Jason walking through Times Square, which is pretty fun. But other than that, it's all Vancouver or a set that's supposed to be like an ocean liner. And then the ending of Jason Takes Manhattan, things get really weird when like this little baby Jason appears and it's just bonkers. It's not good, but it is kind of crazily entertaining in some ways.
That's technically 8.
Well, then there's Jason Goes to Hell.
Yes.
Which I don't like at all.
No.
I'll take Jason Takes Manhattan over Jason Goes to Hell.
Yeah. And then we have Spacen.
Then we have Jason X, which I like quite a bit.
Yes.
And then we have Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah.
See, this is where you and I differ. I like Freddy versus Jason a lot. I think Freddy versus Jason is a lot of fun. I like Freddy. I like Jason. I like seeing them go to head-to-head. It's a great time. What's not to love? Why don't you like Freddy versus Jason?
It's fine. I just, look, if we're going to do a marathon of Friday the 13th films, of course, I will watch all of them like I do every year with the Halloween films.
Yeah, but you only do that because I do it, because I'm a Halloween franchise fan.
You're also a Friday the 13th franchise fan. We have the box set of that too.
But the problem is there's not usually enough Friday the 13ths every year in which to watch all of the Friday the 13th movies. With Halloween, you have the whole month of October to get through all of the Halloween movies. We need to pick a month that's Friday the 13th month and just watch all of them like we do with the Halloweens.
We should do that. There's definitely got to be a Friday the 13th coming up that we could dedicate that entire month to Jason Voorhees.
Well,
and co.
You need to get on it.
I'm on it. I'm searching the calendar right now.
But why don't you like Freddy versus Jason?
I don't dislike it. I just don't really care. Like I've made it clear how I feel. It's 1 through 6 for me. And I like the remake.
But you haven't given me a reason why you don't like it.
I don't need to see them together battling it out.
It's just that you don't like seeing Freddy fighting
Freddy
Jason?
Freddy needs to stay in his world and Jason stays in his world. Never the two should meet. They don't need to.
That's like saying Godzilla shouldn't fight King Kong.
Totally different.
I disagree wholeheartedly. And this needs to be settled once and for all on a podcast.
We should have talked about this before we got married.
Yes, we should have. This should have been covered in our vows. But I also do really like the remake, if you want to call it a remake.
I don't know. Is it a remake?
I don't think so. I mean, it does kind of try to quickly cover the events of the original and throws in the bag over his head. You know, it sort of tries to cover that in the beginning, but then it kind of just goes off and to its own direction. A lot of people don't like that movie, and I don't understand why. I feel like the people that don't like it think that it's not true to the spirit of the franchise, which I think is absurd.
I think it's absolutely absurd. It's doing exactly what we came for.
I mean, I guess it's a little bit slicker in terms of filmmaking.
Right, but I mean, it was done in what, like 2010? I can't even
2009.
Remember. 2009. 2009. It's a slicker time. What are you going to do? I disagree as well. I don't know why you wouldn't like that. You're just getting a new version of what you want.
And I really like Derek Mears as Jason in that.
He's a good Jason
and a good guy. Yeah. We've hung out with him
Friday Night Frights. That's right.
He was a very good guy.
Very good guest.
So, yeah, I mean, I like that movie and I have always liked it. I saw it in the theater and I enjoyed it and I don't understand why people don't like it. I think those people aren't true Friday the 13th fans.
Well, you might say that about me because of my hesitance against Freddy versus Jason.
I do think that. Yes, it's true. I'm questioning your
commitment to Jason and Freddy.
That's right. I'm throwing down Freddy's glove and demanding a duel.
I think with the remake, if you want to call it that, like it's sticking more to the formula, right, for Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it just gets too silly with now we've got Freddy and Jason battling it out. Like, I'm not here for that. I'll gladly watch it. It's just not a go-to for me. It's not a like, ooh, I want to put on Freddy versus Jason.
It is kind of a go-to for me. I will throw on Freddy versus Jason.
It's no skeleton key.
Yeah, it's no skeleton key.
But back to 1 through 6, which are the best of the franchise, in my opinion. I think I agree with you. I think 4 is the most solid.
Mm-hmm.
I really love 5.
You really love 1, too.
I do love 1. Well, because 1 and 5 are kind of doing a similar thing with such a whodunit.
Right.
Because, you know, with 5, as we'll get into, you think it's one thing and then it's not.
Yeah.
And it's a very silly, ridiculous whodunit, but I love a whodunit.
Well, in both cases, it's a silly whodunit because in part 1, you don't know who's killing everyone. And it turns out to be somebody you haven't even met.
You haven't even seen. But in part 5, you have.
If anything, part 5 plays more fair by the whodunit rules. In fact, I think it plays it almost a little too obvious to who the killer is.
I know we'll get into the film, but I have to say, as we're watching it again for the millionth time for the podcast, I just was really just enjoying some of the camera work as far as like and lingering on the person who it's going to turn out to be.
Yeah, the coverage really tells you everything you need to know.
We would also be remiss not to acknowledge Friday the 13th, the series, even though there's no Jason Voorhees in that. It does have the same name. It had the same producer. And it's a wonderful series. If you haven't watched it, you should.
No, you shouldn't. And I need to take a stand here, and I'm taking it against you and also against co-host Troy, who also inexplicably loves this dumb series. This series is terrible. It's not good. There's no Jason in it. So right off the bat, it's bad. Why is it even called Friday the 13th? And yeah, it's silly and dumb. And Freddy versus Jason is way better than that dumb TV show.
The TV show is excellent. I used to stay up late at night on, I think it was on Friday nights, because it wasn't even in the TV Guide sometimes. It would just come on, like on, it was like WGN or something.
Right. TV Guide wouldn't even accept that it's existence. On.
But sometimes it would just show up like around midnight or something. And I would stay up hoping that it was going to come on. And most of the time it did. And I really enjoyed it. And I have rewatched it. And some of it is not as good as I remember in some ways. But I will still hold true for Mickey and Ryan and Jack as they're fighting against Uncle Louis Vendredi. Friday and Francais. He made a pact with the devil.
Yeah. How old were you when you were watching this? Like 11 or
probably,
something?
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of things that you like when you're 11 years old don't quite hold up in your adult years.
I think it's, if you haven't seen it, folks, I think it's worth a watch. It's out there probably on YouTube somewhere, I guess. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere else.
I say life's too short. But we're not here to talk about Friday the 13th, the series. We're here to talk about Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning, directed by Danny Steinman, who was mostly known for doing softcore pornography. And I think you can tell that from this movie.
Yes, it's pretty apparent that that's where he came out of. And I think he, you know, was into horror. And I was reading about him a little bit. It looked like he was supposed to be up for like a Last House on the Left remake, but that ended up not happening. So yeah, I think he was a horror fan, and I think he makes a fine horror film, but yes, you can definitely see the softcore Skinamax happening.
Definitely. You can see that influence in the film. Now, Danny Steinman did pass away, I think, a few years ago.
He was in 2012, I believe.
Yeah. So RIP Danny.
Yeah.
Thank you for this lasting entry in this storied series. Now, we are in the midst of what is known as the Tommy Jarvis trilogy. And if you're not a Friday the 13th fan, there is three films sort of nestled in the franchise that sort of center around the character of Tommy Jarvis. Tommy Jarvis is introduced in Friday the 13th Part 4, played very memorably by Corey Feldman. And at the end of Part 4, Tommy, who's like, I don't know, 11 or 12 at the time, kills Jason with a machete. He sort of shaves his head and makes himself look like baby Jason or young Jason as we first met him in Part 1, and that gives him enough of an advantage to then hack Jason with a machete. And so we're picking up after Part 4, we're picking up now 5 or 6 or 7 years later. He's supposed to be a teenager. Like most 80s horror movies, he's now played by a 20-something, not a teenager, but we'll let that slide for now. I can't even remember the name of the actor who plays him. He's a real Blanderson.
John Shepherd.
Sorry, John Shepherd, if you're out there listening. Yeah, it's hard to remember your name. Yeah, he doesn't really look like Corey Feldman, but we do start the movie with Corey Feldman. They got Corey Feldman for a day of shooting. He was shooting Goonies, mm-hmm. which would go on to become a much more profitable and famous movie. He did give them a day of his time, and they actually shot that beginning in his backyard. That is shot in Corey wow. Feldman's backyard, because that's all he was willing to do. They set up some rainmakers and made it look like it was raining, and they have this corny scene where he's seeing these two guys digging up the body of Jason Voorhees. Of course, as soon as they uncover the coffin, Jason comes to life and murders them. And all the while, like, Corey Feldman is just standing there, like, in his raincoat, going like, and it's obviously not his voice. They obviously dubbed somebody else doing the kind of moaning or whatever. He doesn't run away or anything. He just stands there, and Jason just comes right up to him and, like, raises the machete, and then he wakes up as played by John Shepherd.
Right.
Now, when we were watching this last night, you thought that there were going to be the typical Friday the 13th sort of recaps here, but that didn't happen.
No, and it, you know, I've seen this movie so many times. It's actually the one that I saw. I had to see, like, Friday the 13th, definitely 1 through 3. I saw, like, on VHS by renting those. I can't remember if 4 was on HBO, but 5 was on HBO a lot. Like, I saw 5 so many times, and I really enjoy it. So yeah, I don't know why. I was thinking, for some reason, I was picturing him, like, shaving his head and doing, like, a little bit of a recap at the end of 4, but we don't get that in this film.
It definitely would make sense for them to do that, and they had done that. They had done little recaps for all the previous movie, but I think, you know, because this is a new beginning, they're not doing it that way. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, it's fine, whatever. But yeah, it was weird because, like I said, I've seen this so many times and I just was picturing more at the beginning.
So Tommy Jarvis is being brought to a halfway house for troubled teenagers because Tommy has suffered as a result of his experience with Jason Voorhees, and he's sort of withdrawn and kind of surly and, you know, just generally unhappy with things, it seems. So they are bringing him to this sort of halfway house that is incredibly, like, permissive and open. Like, there's these two kind of, like, I don't know, freewheeling, almost hippie types who are running it. This guy who looks like a soap opera actor who barely figures into the story.
Matt.
I'm not going to remember any of these characters' names.
I got you. You got me with all the Lord of the Rings. I'm here with the New Beginning folks. Yeah, it's Matt and Pam.
I did remember Pam's name.
And Pam actually was on General Hospital.
Oh,
so,
was she?
So she does kind of have a soapy look to her, too. I mean, they're both really good looking.
Yeah, I figured she was a softcore actress.
No, she was on soaps and did a lot of TV.
The actress playing Pam, and I don't know her name, she's not terribly good at all. Some of her line readings we were really chuckling at later on in the movie.
Her name is Melanie Kinneman. Yeah, the one line in particular that happens later in the film, not spoiling anything, is she says, you know, everybody, of course, in typical Friday the 13th fashion has gone missing. And it's like a bunch of people. Like, I want to say it's like at least 4, if not more, people that have gone missing. And she's like, I'm going to go find them all. Really, Pam? You're out, like, in the woods of Crystal Lake, I presume.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about this. Once you get past part 2, as I mentioned, the camp isn't really factored in very much. So it just becomes Jason chasing people around the vicinity of Crystal Lake.
Right.
And they never really fully explain how close they are to Crystal Lake or anything. And you would think that they would take this poor Tommy Jarvis kid as far away from the Crystal Lake area as possible. But I guess not. I guess he's somewhere near Crystal Lake.
Yeah, I mean, it was so odd to me that I was like, out of all of the halfway house rehabilitation places in the States, like, you can't leave where this horrible, like, thing happened to you. Like, you have to stay, like, in the vicinity of where you, like, fought a psychopath and your family was killed.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be going many, many states away. But no, he's still somewhere near Camp Crystal Lake.
Adjacent.
That's a good one. You know, this is all just a setup, and we don't have to belabor the plot of this because the plot is Jason, quote unquote, shows up and starts killing people. But the whole setup of this being in a halfway house is just to give us more victims.
So many bodies, by the way. And I was remarking about this last night. This quote unquote Jason, this is one of the more high body counts for a Friday the 13th.
Yeah, it's great because not only do they set up like a pretty decent number of teenagers to kill, it's like Danny Steinman wasn't satisfied with that. So no. We get all these other characters brought in from the surrounding areas, some of them having fuck all to do with anything.
No, there's the hillbilly neighbors.
The hillbilly neighbors, but at least the hillbilly neighbors
are irritated with the kids.
Are irritated like, with the kids fucking on their property.
Yeah. But then the two greaser guys.
That is like something that is just seems they shot out on the road somewhere and just threw it in the movie because they didn't have enough running time or something. It literally has nothing to do with anything.
No. And then there's also, well, the only connection to for Lana and Billy, which Lana's the waitress and Billy is the guy's coming to pick her up with the Coke.
I believe his name is Billy Coke.
As it should be. He's got the Coke. He is the one that I believe drops Tommy off at the facility.
That's right. Yes.
So we see him there. That's the only connection he somewhat has to this. And then there's Reggie the Reckless, who is the kid who lives at the facility because his gramps works there.
As the cook.
As the cook. So is like, you know, precocious, what, 12-year-old maybe?
If that.
If
yeah.
that. Grandson is staying there and his brother Demon is in town. So they go to see Demon and his girlfriend Nina
yeah.
at the trailer park, which is illuminated in neon, a sign that says trailer park.
Yeah.
Just in case. Like that's how that works. But yeah, he gets them too. And they're just, I mean, they're kind of adjacent because of Reggie, I suppose. But
yeah.
like, yeah, there's like all these people who are just living their lives outside of the, as they so nicely call it, the nut house, mm-hmm. is what everybody refers to this
and
place.
The ambulance driver gets murdered.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Tons of people get
Tons
murdered.
Tons of people outside of like a good chunk of kids, 20-something kids. No one really looks like a teenager.
Well, let's talk just a little bit about the setup here.
Yes.
So Tommy arrives at this very permissive halfway house, and we get a real sense that these two counselors or whatever they are really aren't keeping an eye on things, because first the two teens come in who've been out fucking in the hillbilly's yard, and you know the sheriff has got to come, and then the hillbillies come over and make a scene. I really love the hillbilly
Ethel
the mother, and then Junior. Who's her son, who I don't know, looks like a bargain basement Randy Quaid or something. And Ethel is just a hilarious character who will be featured wonderfully later. So one of the teens staying here is Joey. Joey's main characteristic is that he's fat, annoying, and he loves chocolate. And he loves eating chocolate so much that there's like chocolate smeared all over his face, even though like the character has got to be supposed to be like 17 or something, and the actor is probably 30 something. And he's bugging two of the girls because he wants to help them with the laundry. And, you know, he's got chocolate all over his hands, so they don't want him to help. And, of course, he grabs the white laundry sheets with his chocolatey hands. He keeps offering everybody a chocolate bar.
Who walks around with a chocolate bar? And he's gripping the one bar in his hand so tight that it's just melted, fudgy hands all over the place. And then he's got like a backup bar with him, too.
And he goes over to this psychopath who's chopping wood, Vic, I believe.
Yeah.
And he keeps trying to pal up to Vic. And Vic ain't having it. Vic is just like, get out of here. Leave me alone. And Joey's getting all butthurt about it, and he's like, that's not very nice or whatever, but he doesn't even say anything that instigating to Vic.
He was trying to give Vic a chocolate bar or whatever, and he puts the chocolate bar down where Vic is chopping the wood, and he chops the chocolate. And that's when he's like, well, have it that way then, or whatever, you know. He's like, I'm just gonna go over here. If you want me to help you, just let me know or something. I mean, he's like making these like kind of threats. But then also just like, but I'm still here. Like same thing with the girls. After he messes up the sheets, he's like, well, fine, have it that way then. I'm going over here. But if you need some help, or, you know, he's such a ridiculous character.
Yeah, and this just sets off Vic, and Vic just plants a axe in the back of Joey's back.
And I think one of the complaints of fans, and this is not the film's fault because this is the time of Tipper Gore.
Yeah.
Is that you don't really get a lot of gore. Tipper Gore took away the gore.
Yeah, I mean, it translates mostly to you don't see a lot of things, like you don't see the knives going in or right. The axe connecting. They'll try to show you like the aftermath and a lot of these things, but they clearly cut out the moments where gore is employed.
Right.
And this happens to the Friday the 13th movies from like this one all the way up to Jason Goes to Hell. The gore is all cut out of it. And it's a real shame because why else are you here, really?
I know. So it's like you get Joey. It's implied that he's getting hacked to pieces. You just see the axe come at him. But then you just see him later on the ground covered in a sheet. And it's, you know, the sheet's all bloody. And it's not until the paramedics show up and they go and, you know, lift it up. And then you see.
You see that he got his arm chopped off.
I know. There's like. And they just set the arm on his back. So it's just there. Yeah, Vic really went to town.
Now, the reason why this is important is because this is going to set up who our real killer is. And let's just go ahead and spoil it, because everybody who knows the series knows that it's not really Jason that's going to be going on a murder rampage in this movie. It's Roy. And Roy is one of the two paramedics who arrives to deal with Joey's dead body. And Roy doesn't acknowledge Joey as anybody that he knows, but we're going to find out at the end of the movie that Joey is like his son or something.
Yes. Well, and it's so great because this is what I was referencing earlier when Roy comes over and his paramedic pal, I don't know his name, we never get his name, that's working with him. His distinguishing trait is he's like obnoxiously chomping gum and he's like, hey, you got to give me a hand, Roy. And he was like, and everybody's all like, when he lifts back the sheet, of course, it's gruesome. And it's, you know, blood and the arms on top of his back. And everyone's like, oh, and he's like, bunch of pussies. And we see Roy's face. And it's just like the camera lingers on him for such a long time. And he's just like, like with his mouth open and just like really bothered by it. Whereas it's like, if you're paramedic, you know, you shouldn't really be that shocked by most things.
Well, and it's also just clearly broadcasting that this guy is having some sort of psychotic break or something. So it comes as little surprise at the end of the movie when we find out that it's not Jason back from the dead. It's actually Roy. And another big indicator, once the killings start happening in earnest, is that the killer, although he looks like Jason has looked in previous films with the hockey mask and the coveralls and everything, his hockey mask has blue markings on it rather than Jason's normal red markings. So that should clue you in that this is not the actual Jason, but fake Jason.
But it is a new beginning.
It is a new beginning. And I mean, I guess you could think maybe Jason went out and got himself a new hockey mask.
Why wouldn't he? Jason can have a new mask, but I'm just going to go ahead and jump to the end when it's finally revealed that it's Roy, because this is also just too sweet. When the police are saying, yeah, it was Roy, and they're like, we found his wallet. And they open up his wallet, and the first photo in the wallet is a picture of himself.
Yeah, and it's not even like an ID or anything. It's just like a regular portrait of himself.
Yeah, it's like a school portrait of himself in his paramedic uniform, not an ID. And then don't worry, because then we flip to the next page, and it's a picture of Joey, like a recent picture of him. And we also found these clippings. He has these newspaper clippings about Jason Voorhees all in his wallet.
He made it easy for everybody to figure out who the killer was.
But, you know, when you're young and you haven't seen this and it's the first time you're watching it, there are like a lot of, you know, red herrings along the way as to, you know, who could have done it. You know, could it be Tommy?
Because he's the main one,
but it's also like, maybe, you know, Ethel hates these people, or Junior, you know, I mean, not that Ethel, she's pretty small that she could handle this, but maybe Junior, I mean, we don't know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the notable kills. Yes. We don't even have to do it in order necessarily. I want to talk a little bit about the greasers.
Yeah.
Because they just come in sort of randomly. These two greasers who look like they're straight out of Sha-na-na or something.
Stephen King's nightmares.
Their car breaks down on the road nearby for whatever reason. I don't know if they're like supposed to be gay leather boys or what, but they've got this really contentious relationship. One of them is like a real bossy asshole. He's making the other guy get out and try to fix the car. And he's just like, you better fix the car, you better fix it or whatever. And the guy's like, I don't know what to do, man. And so there's just this whole scene with them sort of arguing. And then the bossy one's like, I got to go take a crap. And so he just leaves to go into the woods to take a crap. Now, this is not going to be the first time a character in this movie needs to go take a crap.
That's right.
And it leads to his demise.
Yep.
Because while he's out taking a crap, his buddy is still trying to fix the car. And then Roy, a.k.a. Jason, comes up with a flare, a road flare, and shoves it into his mouth and kills him that way. So we get a brief shot of that. And then the bossy greaser comes back, and this is another thing that we're going to see a lot in this movie, is he's like singing to himself.
Oh my God.
And there's like three different scenes in this movie where people who are about to be killed just sort of improv sing to themselves. He's going, rat-a-tat-tooie, rat-a-tat-tooie.
It's clear that the director was like, just sing a little ditty. All three of these like songs are clearly just made up on the fly, and they're ridiculous. Each one gets more ridiculous.
Yeah, later we're going to get a really memorable song sung to the character of Demon in a porta potty. Ooh, baby, you know, they could do a whole like mixtape of these Friday the 13th Part 5 made up songs.
At least that song, at least they both can kind of carry a tune a little bit. I mean, and that kind of sounds like it could have been applied to some song down the road, but like, the Ratatouille.
Yeah.
And then there's also Lana, who's singing a song like when she's putting her lipstick on to go meet Billy. Something like, I don't know if he loves me or something like that. It's just like, clearly the director was telling these people, just like, make up some little ditties before you get killed.
Make up some ditties while you show your titties, because Lana just inexplicably undoes her blouse to look at herself in the mirror in the diner she's working at before she goes out to meet her coke-snorting date, Billy.
Lothario. I believe she also says it's showtime.
That's right.
For the lack of gore, there are boobs galore.
Speaking of which, we should talk a little bit about Debbie Sue Voorhees.
That's right.
Who is not a character in the movie, but the actual name of an actress playing a character in the movie. And she and her boyfriend are the horny teens that keep getting caught on Ethel's property.
That's right.
So we get a scene where they sneak off yet again to have sex somewhere in the woods. And yeah, we see her boobs, and they are enormous.
Yeah, and in the trivia, there was originally a 3-minute long sex scene between her character and I can't remember what the guy's name is. I guess it doesn't really matter. He's the brunette guy that she keeps screwing around with. Those are two names that I can't remember. I can remember pretty much everybody else, but they just kind of are lost on me. Anyway. But the MPAA forced them to cut it out to 10 seconds.
Yeah, Danny Steinman was quoted as saying, like, I shot a whole softcore porn that they cut out of this movie.
Frank Mancuso Jr., who also produced Friday the 13th, the series, was a producer on this film. And he called Steinman a pervert and called the film a softcore porn sex movie rather than a slasher horror film.
Well, Danny Steinman seems to be taking it as a point of pride.
A compliment.
So yeah. I think there were some different attitudes about what a Friday the 13th film should be going on set.
And poor Deborah Voorhees had revealed also later in an interview that the nudity in this film ended up getting her fired from a teaching job.
Oh, really?
Later. Yep. At two schools years later, because the boys got a hold of the topless images from the film and text messaged them around the school.
That sucks.
I know.
She shouldn't be punished for something she did years before. And it wasn't like a porn film. Not even.
Not that whatever.
Yeah, not that you should be punished for that either. But yeah. I mean, come on. That's lame.
It's super lame. So poor Deborah Voorhees with that. And then another thing, just because I'm sorry, we have to talk about all the boobs because there's so many boobs in this. Melanie Kinneman, who plays Pam, she said her favorite scene in the film are the scenes where she actually has the wet t-shirt. Because she thought she didn't look good in the film until they turned the sprinklers on. So, yeah, because they're, of course, in true Friday the 13th tradition, at the end, she's, you know, it starts raining and she's wearing a white button-down shirt. And no bras in this film at all. So she's, you know, running around and it's like completely clingy and see-through. But that's when she thought she looked best, which I think is quite funny.
So anyway, back to Debbie Sue Voorhees.
Yes.
She is killed by a pair of garden shears. And it's great because while they're having their sex scene, there's this like hobo or something who earlier in the film has gone to Ethel's farmhouse to shovel shit out of the chicken coop for a meal.
Yeah, that's right.
That's when we get to see a glimpse into Ethel and Junior's life at home, and Ethel's making her stew and yelling at Junior, and Junior's eating the stew and it's really repulsive because it's just dripping down his face. But anyway, this poor hapless hobo is watching them have sex, and then he gets stabbed, and then Debbie Sue Voorhees gets stabbed, and then the guy comes back and he gets like a belt thrown around his head and pulled against a tree.
Like a device.
And the belt is tightened until he is killed by it, we are to presume.
I think he's just named Pete, if I remember. She's Nina.
Okay, well.
It's important.
It's so important.
It is.
These characters we've come to really love. Such rich characterization there.
Well, there are actually some characters that I do appreciate. Like, first of all, I always thought, I thought Violet was super cool.
Violet is fun.
Yeah. And the kid that's playing Reggie the Reckless was Dudley from Different Strokes.
Yes, he was the one who was molested by Gordon Jump playing Neptune King of the Sea on the show, not in real life.
No.
In a very special episode.
Very special. So, yeah, I mean, there's some people there that I do care about.
We can't just mention Violet and not mention her awesome dance scene.
She's the coolest. She's also got really cool hair. Like, she's super new wave. She kind of has the Terry Nunn Berlin look going on, where she's got, like, I think she kind of has blackish roots, but then she has, like, platinum hair and then black on the ends.
Yeah.
And just, you know, really heavy makeup. And her hair's crimped, which I totally had a crimper and was totally into all of that stuff. Yeah, and she's just always wearing her Walkman and listening to some new wave-ish type.
She's supposed to be goth or something.
Right.
But when we see her room, there's all these different musical artists in there that don't qualify at all for goth.
Like Alan Sting Parsons and, Project. Yeah. And a lot of Annie Lennox photos
Rick
and stuff.
Rick Springfield.
But also noting her room, like, this whole setup is weird. Violet's got a room to herself, it looks like. And it looks like she's been there for years. The set decorators, the art department spent a lot of time on Violet's room, which you only get to see in, like, one scene, really.
Yeah.
But it's, like, papered top to bottom with, you know, different bands and you know, whatever. All that stuff. But then it's, like, we see Robin, who is this another person who's going to get killed by Jason Voorhees. We don't really have much to do with her. She's watching like a horror movie with all of a sudden this character, Jake, who we don't get introduced to until like a couple days later, I feel like.
No, he's in the scene where they're all eating
at the breakfast.
He stutters. But that's his character.
That's his thing, is he stutters, but he's not there like before when we meet everybody else. We get pretty much see everybody else. We know who everybody is, and Jake just shows up. Anyway, what it doesn't really matter, but Jake's like trying to put the moves on Robin as they're watching, you know, a horror film or something.
It's
suspenseful.
It's an old film with
Shelley Winters, yeah. And yeah, Robin's just like hanging out in her robe. Yeah, it's real loosey-goosey here at the recovery center. But yeah, and then Robin goes up to her room, and she's got bunk beds. And also, again, more boobs. It's just odd to me. I'm like, she obviously has a roommate. She's got bunk beds. and she's just going to like strip down to her undies.
You're trying to apply too much thought to this. Know. These are just setups for the characters
and
to
just
get killed.
More,
they're not
more
giving
nudity.
It thought and being like, why does Robin have a bunk bed and why does Violet have her own room?
It doesn't really matter. I'm just saying, after seeing this for so many times, I'm just like,
what's the song that's going on? There's a man with no life in his eyes.
Do, 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 do.
And she's doing this awesome, like, kind of break dancing
kind
moves.
Of like robot-y type thing.
Popping and locking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and at this point, Jason, a.k.a. Roy, is just going around just sort of killing them all one by one really quickly. You can tell, like, not a lot of thought and effort has been put into this part of the movie
not at all.
I don't even remember how Violet gets killed.
He just stabs her with the machete, like, right between her boobs.
Okay, so he stabs her, and then he meat cleavers the nerdy guy.
Jake. One that was stuttering?
Yes.
Yeah, well, he got meat cleavered before, and then he goes in to Robin's bunk bed, and we get the traditional Friday the 13th stab up through the bunk bed.
Right, which we saw in part one with
Kevin Bacon. Yeah, except we don't get the gore of that. We don't get it going through her throat, really.
No, it goes through her boobs, too, I believe, only through her back.
Yeah. So those three get wiped out, and we've already got, going back to the ooh, baby, when they go to visit Demon and Nina at the trailer park. Like you said, Demon goes into, it's a outhouse, really.
He goes into the outhouse because of those damn enchiladas. And he's played by an actor named like Freddie Nunez Jr. or something. He's also in Return of the Living Dead. So he's been in a few horror movies. He's a lot of fun presence.
Yeah.
He's wearing like all leather. He lives in a van with his girlfriend, smoking weed and drinking and eating whatever they want, including pizza. Pam agrees to take Reggie to visit his brother, who's at the trailer park, and Demon is in there. He opens up the van door. Reggie looks in and he's like, cool. And then he looks over and like, where'd you get that? And indicating Demon's girlfriend.
Nina.
And Nina's like, hey, little brother. And she's like smoking a joint. And like Pam is all cool with all of this. She's just like, oh, this is great.
Well, Demon goes, oh, that's my girlfriend, Nina. And then Reggie goes, come here, Pam. That's my girlfriend, Pam.
Right. Yeah.
And Pam just kind of smiles, which is kind of cool. I mean, it was, you know, but yeah, everything's real, real loose.
And while this whole scene is going on, Junior has confronted Tommy Jarvis, mm-hmm. who, considering that this movie's supposed to be about Tommy Jarvis, he just kind of disappears.
He just kind of wanders off for a lot of it. But I think, you know, we're supposed to think that he's off killing.
Right. Yes.
But Junior shows up, and Junior doesn't know that he's affiliated with the house at first, because that's another thing is, like, you know, we even got it from the greasers. Like, they were like, oh, or, you know, one of them had said to the other, oh, are you scared because of that killing at the nut house? Like,
yeah.
Everybody knows, like, about this house and this small community. Anyway, so Junior doesn't know that. Like, he just comes over to, like, just scare some rando. Like, he just thinks he's a guy, and he wants to, like, he's like, ha, ha, I scared you. Yeah. Like, he comes up on his motorbike and is just like, ha, ha, I got you, didn't I? And then he looks over and sees the truck from the house and knows that he's, you know, with them, and a fight ensues.
Well, a fight ensues, and Tommy, like, kicks his ass. I mean, it obviously becomes like stuntmen, because like Tommy's like pulling some serious like fight moves on Junior,
yeah,
and kicking his ass. So that happens, and then Tommy runs off. Then Reggie the Reckless and Pam leave, and we get the scene where Demon has to take a shit because of those enchiladas.
We have to give a moment for all the food he had in the van.
I did. I said he had pizza. I said he had enchiladas. I said he had, didn't he have something else?
I want to say he had like chicken or egg rolls or something. I mean, yeah. He had like a smorgasbord he kept trying to pull out to see like if Pam wanted something to eat.
Yes.
So anyway, obviously his stomach is quite upset.
So he goes to this like corrugated metal outhouse, and he's taking a really relieving shit in there. And then the first sort of jump scare is that it starts shaking, but it's really his girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
Nina, and she starts singing the song, ooh, baby, which he returns and mm-hmm. sings back to her. And then Jason comes and starts killing them both with a big spear that he's like running through the shit shack.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, because Junior is so upset, we get the scene where he's just riding his motorcycle like a crazy person around the shack.
Right, around their house.
While Ethel is trying to make him her stew. Get in here and eat my stew.
It's the grossest looking stuff. And Ethel's hands are so dirty and her nails are so dirty. And she's just cutting up these veggies and chopping this chicken to pieces and throwing it in this giant pot.
Yeah, earlier we had seen her with the chicken and she's like, I'm gonna chop you up, to the chicken, like just loving that she's gonna cut up this chicken, which I know you as a vegan probably really appreciated.
But
so she's just really into her cooking, but she's filthy and gross because she's a hillbilly. And Junior gets his head chopped off as he's driving around the house on his motorcycle screaming. And then Jason, a.k.a. Roy, just reaches in through the window and grabs Ethel and slams her head into her own stew pot.
That's right.
So that's how she dies.
Doing what she loved.
Doing what she loved. But I really do love those two characters.
They're a lot of fun. Ridiculous. And Junior just repeats everything that Ethel says. And she's like, you dumb.
Yeah.
And calls him like a fucktard or fuckwad or something. Like, it's a really loving mother-son relationship.
Those are the main sequences that sort of stand out. All of the good sequences, I mean, and I'm using the word good loosely, the fun, silly, campy, over-the-top sequences are not the ones that are related to the actual teens in the halfway house. Like, other than Violet's dancing death or whatever, they're all pretty just kind of boring.
What's the most unmemorable, because it happens off screen, is poor Matt.
Yeah.
He doesn't even get a kill on screen.
Right.
Or Gramps.
Yeah.
Like, they're both just like, oh, yep. But I mean, Roy, a.k.a. Jason, got them too. Like, we just discover them. But yeah, we don't even know that they left or where they went or whatever. But Pam is going to find them. And, you know, we find their bodies.
Yeah.
But yeah, they don't even get an on-screen kill.
I feel like maybe those kills were filmed and then Danny Steinman was like, these suck. And so he just came up with these other characters to kill, like the greasers and
maybe
Billy and
Lana,
because they're so disconnected. And I mean, those scenes are way more fun. So it just feels like they just shot a whole bunch of kills and put in the ones they liked. But yeah, so now we're basically at the end of the movie where it just becomes a pretty standard Friday the 13th, chasing them around this farmhouse that's now converted into a halfway home. And it even starts to feel like part three because there's
barn.
A barn.
Yep.
It's pretty much the same set that's in part three with like a hayloft. Like, it's very easy to get those two movies confused at this point. Because they're virtually the same. It's like the same setup. It's like what they couldn't think of anything else other than a hayloft. And we didn't even see this part of the halfway house before.
We don't ever see this until the end where they're running around. And then all of a sudden that features in to like what should be one of the, you know, most climactic scenes. But who cares? I just want this to wrap up at this point. Like, and I like this film, but this part is so not interesting to me. It's just the typical Friday the 13th bullshit with Jason. And it's in this location I don't care about that I haven't seen. It looks very similar to part three. It's not the most fun.
No. Like, at one point, Pam gets into like a tractor and hits him
with
the tractor.
Down. Well, it's like, like an earth mover or whatever, and like knocks him down.
But then they run into the barn. And at that point, Tommy shows up and, oh, so it's not Tommy. And then, you know, they have this fight in the barn in the hayloft, very similar to part three.
Yep.
Because in part three, Jason gets hung on a chain.
That's right.
He gets pushed out of that like hayloft window in the barn. And in this one, he gets pushed off the hayloft window and falls onto some spikes that are on the ground. And that's when we find out that he is Roy.
He's just a man. He's not Jason Voorhees, because Jason Voorhees would have popped up from that shit.
Yeah, and we failed to mention, because it's really easy to fail to mention, the scene at the police station with the cop and the mayor, who we never see again.
Yeah, like all of a sudden, the mayor is pissed that there's these killings going on.
Yeah.
And the cop's like, I think it's Jason Voorhees. And then just to get like established that the town is still recovering from Jason Voorhees. Like, it's totally like supposed to be like Jaws mayor or something. Yeah. Like, who cares about coming to visit this place?
And the mayor's like, you want Jason Voorhees? And he picks up an ashtray and he like pours out the ashtray and he's like, that's Jason Voorhees. He was cremated.
Yeah.
It's so useless and superfluous.
Yeah.
You never see this mayor again. No. Who cares? Why is this in the movie at all?
Right.
Who cares about even having the sheriff in the movie? I mean, I guess you have to have him in there for a little bit, but it's like so pointless. And the sheriff doesn't even get killed.
No.
Because he's there at the end. Then we go to the hospital.
Well, but the Roy's partner, the other paramedic, does get killed.
Yeah, he gets killed.
Yeah, but no, none of the police do.
Right, but you think if you're going to set up this character of the sheriff that you're going to kill him, but no.
Nope.
I mean, this movie is horrendously sloppy. If you're looking at this from like a screenwriting standpoint, I mean, I don't even think you can call this a screenplay. I don't think there ever was a screenplay. I'm sure it was just a bunch of scenes they threw together. Apparently, the actors didn't even know they were in a Friday the 13th movie until it started shooting. Like, the name of the movie was called Repetition. Like,
wow.
And they were all kind of upset when they found out that they're just going to be on another Friday the 13th. Because, you know, Friday the 13th movies weren't high prestige pictures. But yeah, so we get this ridiculous denouement in the hospital. You already described the scene where they find Roy's wallet and it's the sheriff going through that. And we get this ludicrous explanation as to why Roy was the one to take up the mantle of Jason. But meanwhile, Tommy Jarvis is in his hospital bed and he has dreams of Pam coming to him, and then he stabs Pam, but then he wakes up and it was all a dream. But then he goes to his dresser that's in the hospital room.
The dresser that's in the hospital room that someone painstakingly has put his clothes and a hockey mask in.
Yeah, and Jason's hockey mask in there. Who did that and why? We'll never know.
I think it was Jason Voorhees.
You think it was Jason?
Mm-hmm.
And so then Pam really does come into the hospital room and she's like, Tommy, looking around for him. And then we see Tommy behind the door in the Jason mask. Oh, and but the window's
blown out.
The window's been blown out.
So it seems like Tommy might have jumped out the window.
Right.
But no, he's, like you said, behind the door, ready to kill Pam because now he's Jason.
Right. And then we zoom into his eye and we cut to black. So now we've gotten two movies that are setting up that Tommy's going to be taking over for Jason, right? Like, that's basically what's implied at the end of part four.
Right.
This one is a red herring take on that, where I guess we're supposed to think that he might be Jason, but I don't know. I never thought that he was throughout this whole movie. And then at the end, they're like, well, maybe now he really will be Jason. And then in part six, they just ditch that whole concept.
Throw that right out the window. And now he's just battling Jason.
In terms of continuity, the Tommy Jarvis trilogy is pretty bad. Plus, we get a new Tommy Jarvis in the next movie. Yep. Another Return of the Living Dead alumni in that. And that's Friday the 13th, part five, A New Beginning. Now, we can't really discuss why it failed, because technically it didn't fail. And the reason why people didn't like it, at the time, I remember, it was just everybody was pissed that it wasn't really Jason.
I think I may have been fooled when I first saw this and thinking it might have been Tommy Jarvis, just for the record. I'm not going to pretend like, I mean, obviously, I know differently now from seeing it, but I don't think when I first saw this, I knew it was Roy. I mean, I was young.
Yeah.
But I didn't know who it was.
I didn't see this one until later, I think. I think I'd already seen part six. I definitely saw one, two, maybe three, and then I definitely saw four. I remember when I saw four, I saw it at like a friend's sleepover when we were like 14 or something. And then I don't remember seeing five. I know it probably was on HBO.
A lot. But you were off doing fun things. You weren't staying home and watching HBO at that point.
But I did see part six on HBO.
I don't know.
So that I remember seeing on cable. I don't know. I just don't think I saw five. Or if I did, I think I'd been warned that it wasn't Jason. And so I was like, well, fuck that. I'm not watching if it's not Jason. And so if it came on, I was probably like, ugh, part five. I don't want to watch that one. So it really wasn't until years later. And by that time, I already knew it was Roy, the ambulance driver, for whatever reason. So it never had the opportunity to fool me. But watching it, it just seems obvious that it's not him.
It does now. But for, you know, I have to be honest. I'm sure when I first saw it, I didn't know.
And we should mention that, you know, one of the characteristics Tommy Jarvis has is that he makes Halloween masks.
That's right.
That's in part four. Mm-hmm. And then in the beginning of this movie, when he first meets Reggie the Reckless, Reggie tries to scare him with a rubber spider.
That's right.
And then Tommy scares him back by putting on this like really frightening like alien mask.
It kind of looks like Alien, but kind of like the monster from the Funhouse a little bit too.
Yes, totally.
So it's pretty terrifying. It's just like somebody, you know, shooting a spitball and coming back with a grenade. It's just like Reggie with this little dorky spider that, yeah, I mean, it would make me, I would totally jump because I'm jumpy if something like that. But then he turns around with this mask that's terrifying. Reggie's just like, geez, man.
Yeah.
It's a mess, but I love it.
I like it too. I would definitely recommend it to anybody who wants to enjoy the Friday the 13th franchise as a highlight. Is it one of the best of the Friday the 13th? I would say no, because it's just ridiculous. But it is one of the most enjoyable, just on a pure camp level, because it's just so random and silly without trying to be silly.
No, it's not trying to be. It's just, I mean, you know, bless these actors because they showed up and, you know, are doing what was asked of them. But it's like what was asked of them is just ridiculous. I agree with you. I think people didn't like it because it wasn't Jason and they were pissed about that. And I think it's also just because of the lack of gore, which again, wasn't the film's fault. That was just the times.
Yeah.
As to what MPAA would allow. Again, in true fashion, it's like, we'll allow women's breasts all over the screen, but not violence. But now it seems like the pendulum has swung again in some ways, you know, where it's like violence is more acceptable than nudity.
Yeah.
It's weird, right?
Yeah, definitely in horror movies.
Yeah.
I mean, on HBO seems to get away with showing boobs and on Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon
like
and stuff. But like in terms of horror movies, yeah, you don't see women going topless very much at all. Certainly not people who are main characters. Like you might get a scene where they walk into a strip club and you see some boobs or something, but it's never one of the main characters, and it's never in conjunction with violence.
Which, I mean, I guess is a good thing. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, that those things should go together. It's just an observation. I think it's also was just a time too, where it's like, especially like in the 80s. I mean, even we've talked about this before, like, you know, things that were PG were, you know, that was just like nudity was okay.
I think what was happening during this time was a reaction to that sort of permissive time of the 70s when, they would show boobs in a PG movie and you could have gore and stuff. And then Tipper Gore came along with the most ironic name
what
ever.
What a waste of a name.
With her and their PMRC. If you don't know what that is, it was a censorship organization led by Al Gore's wife.
Which I know, like, gosh, he's done so many good things, and then her.
And she went after specifically heavy metal music
and rap.
Horror movies.
And rap, too. Yeah.
So two out of three things that I love, heavy metal and horror, she went after.
And all it did was drive up the sales for those things, really, because everybody wanted to get the Parent Advisory, like, album that had the Parent Advisory sticker on it or whatever.
Right.
Like, that's really what it did.
Yep.
So, oh, well. And then like Dee Snider went to court and everything and had a bunch of musicians come and like try to fight her in court.
It was fun times.
Yeah, it was a time.
All right. Do you have anything else to say about Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning?
It's definitely worth a watch if you haven't seen it. I love it. I'm not ashamed. I think it was my idea to get the Roy action figure.
That's right.
So, he's part of our gang of Jasons.
He sure is.
And I'm proud that he is. And long live Roy.
Long live Roy, yes. I would also recommend it, especially if you want something fun and campy to watch this Halloween season that is not going to really disturb you in any meaningful way, unless you just find a lot of boobs disturbing. It's silly. It's fun. Watch it. It's part of the canon.
That's right.
All right. Well, I'm going to go eat some of Ethel's stew and shovel down some chocolate bars and some enchiladas. And then I'm going to go to the can.
Ooh, baby. Ooh, baby. Ratatouille. Ratatouille. I think he loves me. That was the medley.
That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows, one day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.